This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
We're going to carry on with these matters relating to the world of energy. And of course, this is the week where the thousands of delegates are embarking, well, descending upon Glasgow to discuss a lot of issues relating to climate change. It's COP26. And of course, we'll be observing what happens there. And more importantly, the outcomes and the resolutions that emerge from there, because they will have important implications for all of us. And as a country, we've already obviously started putting together some conversations around this. To talk to some of them is on the line now. We are joined by Brian Kamanzi, who is the energy policy researcher at the Institute for Economic Justice. Good evening to you, Brian.
Hello, how are you?
All good, sir. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Now, Brian, I suppose every country is embarking on an equation or the quest of trying to figure out how exactly it maps its way towards 2050. That is the target date that has been set for net zero emissions, except for Saudi Arabia, which recently said the answer must be 2060. But before we get there, what has South Africa done, particularly in relation to the renewable energy space?
Great. Thank you. So South Africa has identified that wind and solar technologies in particular will play a key role in the next 10 years in terms of decarbonizing the economy. With the draft national determined contributions, the focus until 2030 will be energy, thereafter followed by transport. At the moment, solar and wind are primarily at large scale are primarily procured by government through the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producing Program, which essentially allows a private generation to competitively bid for state capacity. So that's the current mechanism that we have, and those are the technologies that we're mainly looking at to decarbonize in the next 10 years.
Now, of course, when people talk about the energy transition, there's always a spectrum of different options and solutions that get put on the table. Wind and solar, talk us through the viability of them and perhaps more importantly, what type of energy in terms of, you know, capacity that they'll be able to deliver to us in the medium term?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot. That's a difficult one. I think that what's important for us to really consider here, and I think a piece of the Institute for Economic Justice put together on the South African Renewable Energy Master Plan talks about how we can capture the most value from whatever wind and solar that we are going to be rolling out as part of our decarbonization plan. At the moment, with the country currently has a central planning mechanism which determines the national, what's called the national energy mix. And by 2030, if it doesn't get revised, we're looking at between 27% and 34% of our energy produced from wind and solar. Now, you see the challenge with wind and solar compared to a number of different types of renewable energy technologies. We've decided to go with wind and solar. We are a water-scarce country, so mass hydro is a challenge. The problem is that wind and solar power are not what is known as dispatchable, in the sense that the sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So you need energy storage to compensate for periods where you don't have the sun or the wind, or you need a complementary energy resource that can deliver power very quickly. Now, coal plants and nuclear plants are not designed to ramp up and ramp down very quickly. So what is often used is gas. So we've seen potential entrance of new gas energy, which is also a fossil fuel, which many of us don't want. But battery banks used in power networks are also very expensive. So it's clear that there'll be trade-offs, and it's clear that at least what we've committed to is around 27% of our national energy mix. Whether that's revised is a matter of debate going forward. But what I think the IEJ wants to talk about is that we are not yielding the maximum benefit from even the modest plans that we do have.
Yeah, and I suppose us ensuring that we obviously harness the best that we can is an important one, particularly when you do already have energy scarcity, thanks in particular to Eskom. Now, talk us through the South African Renewable Energy Master Plan. What exactly does it seek to do, and is this the right roadmap that gets us on the path to ensuring that we become less toxic?
Thank you. So this is one of 14 government master plans. That has been an initiative by the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. The South African Renewable Energy Master Plan is being project managed by an entity called Green Cape, which is a not-for-profit company. And they're currently engaging a wider range of stakeholders from business, civil society, and labor. The IJ prepared a brief for COSATU on this as a way to stimulate discussion amongst the labor movement and sections of civil society. And we really want to make the point here, or we are supporting groups within that space who are making the point here that we need to challenge privatization in this sector, and that a private sector-led transition will not be a just transition, that there is a role looking at how industry has developed internationally. There is a role that local ownership can play in creating decent work, and that we acknowledge and we affirm part of the purpose of the South African Renewable Energy Master Plan is that we yield greater localization. So that is to say, we enhance the capacity and capabilities of our manufacturing base to contribute towards the energy transition. So whatever procurement that we are doing for along renewable energy value chains, that we have a clear plan, that there's a social compact in place between business, labor, and civil society, that we are embarking on an industrialization path. And so the point that we want to make as it enters its drafting phase is that there's a role here for local ownership, not as something that is, not, it's not charity, it's not simply complying to BEE regulations, but is as a central part of building out a viable industrial strategy.
Now, Brian, one of the big risks that that's been sort of identified in relation to the energy transition in South Africa is that, for example, people who are working particularly in coal mines may find themselves displaced if we transition without giving them an opportunity to score a fair shot at getting a job in the new, you know, energy dispensation. How are we dealing with some of those trade-offs that will inevitably emerge once South Africa does indeed start ramping up its green revolution?
So there are a number of initiatives. The president has initiated the Presidential Climate Commission. There are a number of not-for-profit initiatives, the initiatives being led by labor. What's lacking on the one hand is coordination, but we would argue is also a clear industrialization plan. So I think at the moment, the part of the argument here is that at the moment, aspects of the green transition are being private sector led. And so some of the feeders in terms of employment, jobs will be destroyed. Jobs will be destroyed by the closure of traditional industries, of fossil fuel-based industries, of mines. And do we take it that workers will be absorbed into new sectors simply by, market forces? Or will there be a clear plan? Will there be job guarantees? Those are questions that we're helping to put on the agenda and are hoping take center stage. But not only will workers simply be absorbed in these new industries, will these opportunities be decent work opportunities? And from our analysis, those decent work opportunities will really come in manufacturing. So it's also true that the private sector-led transition wants to ramp up as quickly as possible with renewables and fight tooth and nail with government to acquire exemptions to import as much foreign components as they can, because it's lower cost and lower risk. So betting on ourselves involves risk. So we need to compensate for that risk by leveraging local investment capital, i.e. the state, in exchange for local ownership. This is the agenda that we're wanting to drive here, is that in order to create decent work opportunities, we're going to have to bet on ourselves. And we're going to have to we cannot simply leave it up to the market. We can't leave it to a private sector-led transition.
Yeah, and I think obviously markets left to their own devices don't always generate the optimal outcomes for society, particularly when it relates to the type of, goods and services that we all need, because everybody needs to have the lights on regardless of their employment and economic status. So that's a key issue. Now, Brian, one of the other points that tends to emerge is that if we talk about solar, for example, some may say, well, in order to build as many solar farms that will obviously harness the type of scale that you need land. And when there's land scarcity issues, then the question is, can we ever actually get to a point in time where you create enough of these farms to actually make it a substantial contributor to the energy grid?
So I think that there are two levels here, right? On the one hand, that is a concern. It's also we need to look at where the majority of the solar potential, where high concentration of solar potential exists in South Africa. A lot of that is in the Northern Cape. And I think we also need a more tactile understanding. I know Perry, based in Johannesburg at Witwatersrand, has done some research a report called, I think, Whose Power Is It Anyway? Asking serious questions about, you know, what are the costs of electricity in these areas? You know, who's benefiting from the plants that are already there? You know, before we even talk about land shortages in future, who owns that land, right? This is areas of high concentration. So I think to be honest, we're quite far away from the point of saying land scarcity will prevent us from having more solar. But we do have concrete issues around land ownership, but also the distribution of benefits from the existing renewable projects. That's a discussion to be had, right? And I think it's relevant. It will have bearing for the conversation that you're mentioning that will happen down the line. It has bearing on that. But I think the point is, even from what we have, even from our modest build and our ambitions for 2030, we are not set to reap the best benefits. We're not ensuring that the most marginal are receiving the benefits from this new procurement.
Yeah.
And the potential for this new industrialization.
Yeah, very important considerations there. Now, Brian, I'd also like to deliberate on some of the recommendations that have come from the policy brief. But unfortunately, I do have to take a short break for Power News, and then we'll come back to you. Welcome back to the Tuesday evening edition of Power Business. We're still talking about the country's energy roadmap. We're joined on the line by Brian Kamanzi. He's an energy policy researcher at the Institute for Economic Justice, giving us some insights into the Renewable Energy Master Plan and some of the key considerations there. Brian, I suppose the key thing that we all need to deliberate on is, now that you've done the work and you've obviously interrogated some of the conversations that are going on, you have put together some recommendations that should be of interest to everyone in the country. I'm quite interested in the one relating to market structuring. Talk us through what you guys have recommended there.
Great, thank you. So I think the first point that I want to make is that we made this work in support of Labour, who are participating in the process. So ultimately, Labour will decide how they want to, and if they want to advance some of these ideas. And we're hoping to spur some of the conversation, particularly in areas that are receiving less focus. So in terms of market structuring, we're looking at import tariffs. So we're saying, and here it's really a package deal. On the one hand, we're saying if we want to increase the amount of local content, it's clear, and it's clear from some of the poor performance in our existing rollout, that if we're going to guarantee, if we're going to have market certainty, so that is to say, government will assure, and at the moment, government backs and Treasury underwrites private generation projects under REAP. If we're going to provide these incentives, then we must ensure that we use more local content. And one of the tools that we have available to us is to implement import tariffs, right? And these import tariffs will ensure that we offset the cost of the cheap imported goods and raise the viability of locally manufactured goods, which at the moment are considered, particularly for key components, costly and risky. So in order to offset this, we also suggest that we need to make use of public financing, which can come in at a lower rate than what at the moment, particularly local banks are offering. Yeah. You know, some local banks are making as much as 15% on some of their investments on REAP. So the Reserve Bank can offer, it's possible for us to offer cheap debt at lower rates than that for both manufacturers and for utility scale projects. So we can offset the increase in cost that would be imposed by, we have to admit that by imposing import tariffs and by using more local content, it will cost more to produce energy from renewable energy.
I suppose one of the considerations is obviously how that might distort the market at large. But I remember a couple of weeks ago, National Treasury came out with a notice that says, you know, going forward in relation to public build projects, only locally sourced cement can be used. And for a lot of people, they wanted to know why you don't have just a universal rule that says that all South African procurement should be like that. But I suspect that the government is able to sort of dictate how it wants to transact rather than simply issuing a directive to the market that says do this, because I think that may have some unintended consequences for some of the bilateral trade agreements that we're already part of.
Yes, but it's also, it's interesting when the conversation about the distortion of the market takes place, because nobody talks about that when we talk about using public finances to underwrite these projects and to essentially de-risk them to the extent to which we have, You know, if one takes a sober look at the public incentives that are offered to these private generation projects to say, well, are we really reaping the benefits that we expect to? Are we seeing the kinds of the levels of employment in the Northern Cape that we expect? Are they the type of jobs that we want? And so I think that the market is already distorted. We have created the conditions for the emergence of the renewable energy industry. It will not exist without subsidies. That's a fact.
Yeah. Another key point, another key point, Brian, is obviously, you know, in most of these cases, there's always this very ambitious blueprint on how the project will be put together and how many jobs are going to be created. But maybe the question of monitoring that the jobs are indeed created and that they are the decent type of jobs that are promised has not been something that's been particularly strong. Is this something that needs to be done a bit better?
Yes, I think reporting and transparency is key. So at the moment, some of the figures, first of all, are not available in terms of the granularity that one might want. There's not consistency in terms of reporting of what are the measures that are being used to describe a job, a renewable energy job. There's talk of job years, full-time equivalent years. We need more clearly understandable metrics. We also need to capacitate the regulatory instruments at our disposal that measure and monitor the compliance to local content rules, but also to job and reporting rules. So we need transparency of data. We need to capacitate those arms, which are supposed to be ensuring that we are the regulations we have are being adhered to. If we have any hope of implementing stricter and harsher rules, if we have any hope of those materializing, we need to capacitate those arms that monitor and measure.
In the past 12 to 15 months, Brian, we've learned the hard way that technology transfer is not as easy to sort of get over the line. In fact, in relation to vaccine manufacturing, it's been a struggle where nothing has been happening. In order for us to be able to obviously make this transition and maybe be able to sort of control more of the value chain, we're going to need that to happen. What are the recommendations that you're putting together in relation to the technology transfer aspects?
I think it's first of all, it's key that it becomes part of our everyday language around, you know, there's so much talk about we need to ramp up renewable energy. Renewable energy is going to solve the problem with Eskom. Well, we don't talk about technology transfer. We don't talk about what's happening. Are we aligning what's happening at higher education institutions, at TVETs? What are happening with local manufacturers? Do we have medium to long-term plans of building key components in South Africa? Do we have plans of having a South African or an African turbine? Do we have prospects of building, having the majority of solar panels installed in South Africa, made in South Africa? What is the time scale of that? We can't even begin to have those long-term conversations if we're not creating the conditions for that today, if we're not bringing the relevant government departments on board and saying, what is our technology transfer strategy? It mustn't be vague. It must be clear in those terms. It's clear from examples like, for example, China, who absolutely dominate global trade in terms of solar manufacturing, that a clear transfer technology transfer strategy was absolutely essential. The United States developed most of the key technologies for solar PV, and without technology transfer strategy, China would have never been able to build the scale, among other things, would have never been able to build the industry that they have today. So the same is true for us. If we don't have a plan, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and I think the leadership that government needs to take is something that cannot be disputed, whether it's on the financing side or whether it's actually getting the policy that makes it all conducive for the various players and the role players to participate, and more importantly, for jobs to be created. That is something that definitely needs to happen. What happens next? Does this become a matter of policy deliberation? Is it something that Labour is going to take to government as their view on what needs to happen?
I think a number of these matters are issues that Labour is already taking. I think the question is, what is going to be the appropriate lever and what is the right level for which to engage government? And I think that the step to establish the industry master plans is a positive step in that direction. What will materialize, I can't say. But I think we at IEJ, we are confident and committed to supporting Labour in this process. And we believe that they are a key stakeholder in realizing and advancing some of these progressive demands.
Very important considerations there. Thank you very much to Brian Kamanzi. He is an energy policy researcher at the Institute for Economic Justice. They've done some work on behalf of the labor movement to talk through the country's renewable energy master plan. Some recommendations have emerged from it. It is, of course, an ongoing conversation that all we as South Africans need to monitor, because it affects our future in relation to where the energy of the country is going to come from. Because I suppose we can all agree it's probably not going to come from Eskom, because even tonight and even now, people are sitting in the dark thanks to Eskom's inability to simply execute on the need to deliver energy to us at the time that we needed, which is a time like this when it's very cold today in Johannesburg in particular.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.